Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and convene this meeting of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is March 12th, 2015, and we have been conducting public hearings on Senate Bill 5508, the Employment Department. And we've got a full and fast-paced agenda ahead of us today. I think that what we would like to do is to make sure that that we provide time for anybody who may not quite be in the room yet, that we'll go ahead and do one more segment with the department, and then we'll open it up for public testimony, and then we'll try and wrap with the department. And in order to do that, I need to bang the gavel again and formally open the public hearing on 5508. And Director, where are we at? Who would you like to go next?
Jim Farr.
Okay.
He was on yesterday's.
Right. Let the other chairs go.
Okay. And I will encourage you to be thorough but efficient.
Succinct is the word.
Yes.
Succinct.
So go ahead and introduce yourself and we'll jump right in. Thank you.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. I'm Jim Farr, Administrator for Business Employment Services. So the first slide I wanted to touch base on, Director Eisenfeld yesterday mentioned that we were reorganizing Business Employment Services to align ourselves more closely with the workforce boards. The workforce boards were seven, now they're nine. And we also, by doing reorganizing our Business Employment Services, we also reduced our management by 26% as well. The next slide kind of shows you, gives you an idea of where the workforce boards, the nine, will be. And then the red circles also give you an indication of where we have WorkSource Oregon Employment Department staff in all the different centers throughout the state. Business Employment Services actually has two major customers. It's job seekers and employer relations. We have four major responsibilities. Those are, we deal with reemployment eligibility assessment. We also have job search and recruitment options for both the job seeker and employers. We deal with customized business services where we work with businesses more closely one-on-one to try to find them the best candidate. We refer job seekers to training and other community resources throughout the community within the WorkSource system. And one of the things we're doing is aligning our services with the new WorkSource Oregon standards. One of the things we're moving more towards is a customer service center, meaning that we will be looking at pulling our staff from behind walls, cubicles, and making them more out and visible to the customer as they come in to give them more one-on-one services. Currently, right now, majority of our staff are in cubicles, behind hidden walls. As you walk into a center, we want to make it more viable to the customer that's coming into our center. And we want to look at also co-locating all our offices that are currently, right now, we have about 10 facilities in the state that are not co-located. So our objective is to get those offices co-located and then go to a more centralized service where customers will get more of a one-on-one service from our staff. And the WorkSource Center staff as well. We want to make it more seamless for when the customer walks in, it doesn't matter who they're talking to. They just need the service that they need to get. One of the things we're working on is WorkSource Oregon standards, and these are minimum standards. What we're trying to do is get every WorkSource center to have a minimum standard. So yeah, I've had the privilege of working in multiple centers throughout the state, from St. Helens to the Central Coast to Central Oregon and into Eugene. And it's important that we have some sort of minimum standard for the job seeker and employers that are using our services. What I mean by that is if I was walking in as a customer to the Klamath Falls office, I would get the same services if I was walking into a Portland office, meaning that I would, an example of a minimum service would be in 1 minute I would be seen by, be greeted by an employee, and within 15 minutes I would actually get a service and seen by somebody. Another one is having minimum standards of what we provide as far as technology. So it's important that the technology that we're providing in our centers are the same and give a minimum standard. And also like workshops, currently some centers provide them, some don't. So we'll have a minimum standard of these are the type of workshops that will need to be provided in each center. So every customer gets the same minimum standard. Business Employment Services has many, we perform federal programs. Those are working with veterans. Also, we work with the migrant seasonal farm workers. We have the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. We have the Foreign Labor Certification. And we have worked with the Self-Employment Assistance Program, which David talked a little bit about yesterday. Some of our accomplishments through our reemployment eligibility assessment and working with claimants who come through the system, referring all claimants, we've been able to, per year, reserve about $40 million to the trust fund savings to that by reducing the amount of weeks being claimed with claimants. We've also started where we do with customers business services. We've had some great success with that. And one example I'd like to give you is that we actually have an employer, two employers in our state that has actually also has another business within another state. They've asked us to, the business actually went to the state in this other state and says, why can't you have more services like Oregon as far as how you're working with businesses? So they've asked us to actually talk about what kind of services we provide around the customized business services and want to use that in their state as well. So that's one of the successes that we've had recently. Some of our ongoing challenges and ongoing efforts, we have various different contracts with Department of Human Services and that we run, and so we are looking for limited duration positions as well through some of those POPs, position option packages. We also are looking at, in one of those position option packages for facilities, to redo the facilities so we can do that customer-centered services. So that's one of them that we're looking at as well. And Larry's going to talk a little bit more about those as soon as he talks about the position option packages next.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the committee, Lisa Neisenfeld, Director of OED, I'd also like to add to that, to remind you what we discussed yesterday, that WorkSource is a joint program between the Oregon Employment Department and the local workforce investment boards.
Senator.
Well, I don't want to interrupt. At the appropriate time, I have a question, if I may, on the slide that was just previous. Expand the non-traditional apprenticeship opportunities. Well, I'm not sure what that is. What's a non-traditional apprenticeship?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, members of the committee, we are working with BOLI to look at organizations, particularly in the field of manufacturing. We've decided that's our first stop, to occupations where they have not been apprenticeable in the past, or that they have been apprenticeable in the past, but those have fallen into disuse, and to try and develop those apprenticeships. Apprenticeship has been shown to be by far the most cost-effective training strategy out there. We're trying to utilize that more wherever possible. It takes a group of cooperating employers to do it. But we're trying to expand that and maybe look at some variations on the traditional apprenticeship approach. So also now, because distance learning offers us opportunities to do the classroom instruction in far-flung places, we think that we can do it in rural areas that where we have not been able to get a cohort of people together before.
Okay. Please continue.
I'm sorry, I was just adding about that the workforce boards are our partners in designing and delivering work source services. And when Jim talked about co-location of facilities, that would be co-location between OED-funded sites and workforce board-funded sites. Most of the state is co-located now. We're down to the final 10, and that will be accomplished in the coming year.
Excellent. Is that everything for Mr. Farr?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so very much. What I'm going to do is I'm going to keep rolling with you folks until half past the hour, and then I'm going to go into public testimony at that point. Okay. So who should we bring up next?
Good question. Oh, yes.
Here. So Co-Chair Gumberg, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Graham Slater, and I'm the administrator of the Workforce and Economic Research Group within the Employment Department. So thanks for the chance to share quickly with you today. The primary goal for the research division is quality information, and what we mean by that is accurate, timely, reliable, unbiased, and useful. We serve a wide variety of customers, as some of you know, elected officials, workforce boards, partners in the workforce system, businesses, job seekers, students, colleges, transportation and land use planners, and economic development organizations, among others. People often assume that our primary customers are others within government, but actually our number one customer group happens to be private sector businesses. You'll see news articles like the one on the screen often, and I just like to make the comment that when you see things like that, either the data came from us almost always, or at least it started life with us and then other people have analyzed it, because that's our niche in what we do for Oregon. Our division's organized into several small groups, and if you read this slide from left to right, it gives you a sense of what we do. We collect information from surveys and from administrative records. We analyze that data to produce reports, write articles, give speeches, respond to customer information requests. Some of our staff target their efforts particularly towards private businesses or the education system, and we share our information through our website, blog, and Twitter. We also do the performance measures work for the workforce system, basically saying if someone is served by the state agencies or the workforce boards or the workforce partners, did they find jobs? What were their wages like? Did they stay in those jobs once they found them? So we do a lot of work with unemployment rates, industry and occupational employment, both now and in the future, the need for trained workers, whether in healthcare or manufacturing, or as you talked about just a few minutes ago, apprenticeships, and all other occupations. And then we do a lot of special reports. From our website, you can download from tools economic data to do analysis. We have tools to help students and job seekers make good decisions about their next job or their next training, their next career. And we also have tools to help colleges and workforce boards prioritize the most needed training with limited resources. I have four slides here just to give you the briefest sense of the kinds of presentations we give, and I think they're presentations that help a lot of people make better decisions. For example, the one on the screen right now just shows that dramatic job loss that you're probably very well aware of in the early part of the recession, and then the very slow job gains, so that it took us 7 years to get back to the original job level that we had before the recession started. One of the questions we're always...
Excuse me, Senator Johnson?
Much has been said about getting back to the original level pre-recession. I think that there might be some level of dispute about the quality of those jobs. Could you comment on pre-recession, the profile of the pre-recession jobs versus the return point?
Right, certainly. So Co-Chair Gumberg and Co-Chair Johnson, actually the very next slide will touch on that. So it's a great segue in that one of my comments was going to be a lot of people do assume that the new jobs, the added jobs, are all low wage. And that is absolutely not true. And this slide helps show that the top three industries here that have added the most jobs in the last year all pay above average wages. Manufacturing is fifth on the list. And my point on that is if those industries pay above average wages, that tells me that those jobs require education and training and skills. So yes, there's been some growth in low wage too, but overall, when you look at, say, over the last year like this, it's clear that there's high wage, high education kind of jobs being added in our state.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
It is so nice to have that debunked on the record, because I think the urban mythology is that all of the recovering jobs are burger flippers, and I don't mean that at a, I mean, that they're low-wage jobs. Right. And to have that debunked here is very helpful.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson, that has been a myth in almost every economic recovery, and as you know, I've been doing this for a while, and people always go to that assumption that it's all about low wage, and clearly it's not. So on the record, it's not. Two other graphs that hopefully will be interesting. One is, you know, it's great for me to sit here and say the unemployment rate is down. It was 11.9%, now it's in the low 6% range. But if you're from a rural area, you know that's not the reality. Klamath Falls, 9.1%, two Oregon counties over 10% right now, even as we sit here. And then I also say employment's back above pre-recession levels. And this graph, the top line, shows that the Portland area employment is 10% higher now than it was in 2001. But if we add up the employment across all the rural areas, that employment is 1% lower today than it was in 2001. And if we look at certain counties that you care about, Umatilla down 4%, Klamath down 7%, Grant and Harney down 15 and 17% over those 14, 13 years. So what have we done in the last couple of years that might be particularly of interest? One thing is we kept our commitment to this committee from 2 years ago, and the vast majority of our reports are completely online now, as was requested and as we committed. The second one, as was mentioned yesterday, we did a special report on youth in the labor force. Not the place for a big discussion of it, but suffice to say youth are less likely to be in the labor force than they were in previous years. They're less likely to be employed. And as a result of that, they're less likely to be competitive for the jobs when they do come open, because businesses tell us over and over they want people with work experience. So there's a whole report, there's a whole presentation on that for today. Suffice to say that was one of our big projects. Third, you've heard from...
Yes, Senator Johnson.
This raises a very interesting policy question that this body has wrestled with previously, and that's what to do about internships. Those of us on the panel that are a certain age enjoyed the benefit of internships that were generally unpaid, but they were resume builders and an opportunity to gain some real-world experience. I think there has been a temptation in this building to want to... change the employer-employee relationship with respect to interns. Could you comment on those kinds of introductory opportunities, especially for youth, in terms of preparing someone to think about a career or to pursue a particular kind of career?
Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson. I
guess my point is that if they were to disappear, those opportunities were to disappear, how seriously would that affect a segment of the workforce that already is not fully engaged?
Right. So Co-Chair Johnson, clearly it would be negative. I don't have data in my mind of how many internships. I actually think that Lisa here and some of the local workforce board directors would have a lot more information on that, because they've done it on the front lines, whereas mine's more database. So if it's okay, maybe we can ask some of them to comment as they come to the table.
Sure.
That'd be all right? Okay. The third and fourth ones both relate to that major design of the workforce system that you've heard about a couple times. So for us, part of that means redoing a ton of our data, because we're moving from 7 to 9 workforce areas, and every one of those areas will want information that they can use for planning and strategies. So we're doing that. We're also, similar to what Jim said, we are reassigning and reallocating some of our staff, literally putting them into the workforce board offices to build that collaboration. And we're also going to be changing our website so that any of them can get the information they need just immediately. The second part of the workforce redesign for us is that the workforce system performance measures will be changing, and the research division has been asked to take the lead on that. So we have a federal grant to do the work, and we're working with the local boards and our partners to completely rethink those performance measures for the whole workforce system, and then to gather and analyze the data to make them happen. The final thing I'd like to mention came out of those rural forums, regional forums that Lisa mentioned yesterday, and that is that businesses believe that young people do not understand what's going on in their local economy, what's going on in the broader workforce, and that young people do not understand what businesses need from new workers. And so
Excuse me, Mr. Slater, when you say younger people, give me an example of the target group you were referring to.
Kojak Gomberg, so this particular project is particularly focused on high school age young people. And the goal here is to help work with local boards, work with school districts, work with whoever's doing work in those local areas. And our outstation staff will be trying to help bridge that gap. For years, they have focused very much on businesses' needs, so they know about that stuff. Now they're going to be trying to add their expertise to the connections that are already made so that young people will have a better understanding of what's going on in those areas.
Representative.
You might give some examples. What we heard in Klamath, certainly, or maybe I will, and you can fill in the blank. We have a lot of young people that don't understand that if you take a job, you have to show up for the job every single day. I mean, this is serious. This is what we're hearing from employers. They don't understand some really basic things like you go every day, you go at the same time every day, you dress appropriately, and you know, fill in the blanks. You heard it down there, and it's just amazing what they are not understanding. I don't know if you can contribute more to that, but just to give everybody an example, what they don't understand.
Do you have any from the hearing?
Co-Chair Skomberg and Johnson, Representative Whitsett, members of the committee, you know, I strongly believe that that's what young people, either they learn it at home through their families or they learn it in their internships or first jobs, and that learning it in a classroom is, you know, in one ear and out the other. I absolutely believe that there are many people in the workforce now who don't get that. They don't understand the protocol, that you don't go talk to the president. You know, there's just much to learn that we all take for granted. And so lifting up those work-based learning experiences, whether they're internships, on-the-job training, apprenticeships, things in business where we can most directly get young people and jobs together, we think are the most effective and very, very important.
Well, I just add very quickly, Representative, that this challenge is not limited to your district, nor is it limited to high school age potential employees. But we'll carry on.
So in closing, Co-Chair Gomberg, on these challenges, let me just mention one, and that is it's sort of the middle two bullets. It is a challenge for us that the federal government, A, the funding is stagnant or declining, and that's been true for a long time. But the bigger challenge from my research perspective is that the federal government cares a lot about national data. They care moderately about state data. They care somewhat about metropolitan area data. They really don't care much about rural data for small counties. And that's a battle we fought over many years. And I just want to give one example of what we in the Employment Department have tried to do about that. A lot of states do not have employment data for their rural counties each month. You're all used to seeing the unemployment rate and the employment news for your county. A lot of states don't do that. So one of the great things for us is that 21 of our research staff are located all across Oregon in many of your communities. That's part of their job, is to develop those numbers. So we know for Klamath, for Umatilla counties, we have the same trend information, the current knowledge that we have for Portland and Salem. And that's not true in a lot of states.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
How widely, I'm familiar with your publications, and I'm glad you've moved to the online format because I think it's easier and cheaper to distribute, less expensive. How deep into local government do you penetrate? Are city councils and county commissions able to access that same data?
Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson, if you mean do we have all the data at the city level, the answer would be no. But if you mean, are we connected with cities and county commissioners? Absolutely, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. And Co-Chair Gomberg, that ends my presentation. So thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Slater. I think we would really enjoy having a lot more time to delve into these numbers, although I don't know if it would take us closer to our end goal of assessing your budget request. So, Director, do we have anybody carrying over from yesterday, or are we now at where we plan to start today?
We have two more presentations, not from yesterday, but we have our IT presentation and from the Office of Administrative Hearings. And this would be a good stopping place to,
okay.
to have guests, and then
yeah, we do. We did list. We were going to take public testimony today, so why don't we give you a break?
Right.
And I wanted to invite Ms. Maxim, Mr. McGonnell. Is that correct?
McGough.
Excuse me, McGough, and Mr. Edmund. And that's the order you signed up in, so why don't we go in that order? And if you could introduce yourself for the record, and we'd be very pleased to hear from you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Maxim. I'm the Human Resources Manager at Oregon Aero. I'm going to talk about Workshare this afternoon. I work at Oregon Aero, and we've been in business for about 20 years, 25 years, depending on which owner of the company you ask, Mike or Jude Dennis. We have 60 full-time employees and roughly a dozen additional subcontractors. We specialize primarily in aerospace products, predominantly comfort and safety equipment for every branch of the military and civilian pilots and flight crews. For example, we make padding for the inside of helmets and seating equipment in F-22s, C-130s, Black Hawk helicopters, etc. We design, test, and manufacture all of our products in-house. Everything is made in the state of Oregon, and many of the items that we've and the products that we have come from the ideas of employees and customers alike, and we're really proud of that. A fair amount of our business does come from the government, for example, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, law enforcement, etc. In December of 2013, we accurately predicted that sequestration was going to hit, and we knew that was going to be a challenge, and every one of our employees is highly skilled and talented, and we invest a lot of money in them. So we decided that we were going to start Workshare, and if you're not familiar with the program, it allows people to dip into the unemployment pool for about 1 or 2 days a week, and then they work 3 or 4 days a week, depending. Since we'd used Workshare before, we were able to reactivate our account with the state, and basically the people fill out the form and they drop it into the payroll department the day before they leave for the week, and our executive team decided that what we were going to do is use Friday as our Workshare day so our people could have a 3-day weekend. And Monday morning I turn in the paperwork to Carla Rebo, who's our dedicated rep here in Salem. And the lack of red tape and the ease of use has been reassuring to everybody in the company. But most importantly, the Workshare program has allowed our people to keep their jobs and their benefits. And in a small community such as Skipoose, you can imagine the detrimental effect that people losing their jobs can have. So Workshare has allowed us, again, not to lay off a single person during not only the economic downturn, but the sequestration that we've still continued to feel the effects of today. We've continued to struggle with sequestration, but again, I can't stress to you that we have not, still 2 years later, laid off a single person. We managed to keep every one of our employees employed. If I had one negative thing to say about the program, it's that during the spring and summer months, when work, when our workload becomes a little bit more heavy, it's difficult to get people off the program because they become accustomed to their 3-day weekends. So they tend to make 3-day weekend plans, and we need to remind them that the Workshare program is for company need, not their plans. So that's the one negative thing that I've had to say about the program, is that they tend to get used to having a 3-day weekend. They still get roughly the same amount of pay, so that's an added benefit to the program. We did not hesitate to utilize the program. I wouldn't hesitate to use it again, and as a human resources professional, I'd recommend it to any one of my colleagues. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to ask.
We'll hold questions to all three of you have had a chance, but thank you very much for that. I would not have imagined your industry to be seasonal, so that's something that had not occurred to me. I'll try it again, McGonnell?
McGough. Cough with a G.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, the rest of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. My name is Andrew McGough. I'm the Executive Director of Work Systems. We're the Workforce Investment Board for Washington and Multnomah counties. And I want to just elaborate a little bit on the partnership that Director Neisenfeld talked about, which we all affectionately call WorkSource, and particularly WorkSource Portland Metro. We've been at this since about 2007 in our region. Timing is everything. around about October 2007, we got the notion that, you know, it's time that we really thought differently about how we try and serve job seekers, workers, and industry in our community, and we needed to do that more efficiently, more effectively, and frankly, demand is going up and resources are going down, so how do we figure that out? And we needed to figure that out together. So around about October of 2007, we all got together and we said, okay, we're going to co-locate. We got some guidance from the governor, Governor Kulongoski at the time, and we took it to heart, and we were very eager to engage with this partnership. And then, unfortunately, the economy tanked, for lack of a better term. And but we continued forward with this effort because we knew it was the right thing to do. And so today, we have five centers in Washington and Multnomah County. Some of them are Oregon Employment Department offices. One of them is a private not-for-profit corporation that is co-located with Employment Department staff, as among several others. One is on a community college campus in Beaverton Hillsboro on the new Willow Creek campus. Because of the depth of our partnership, we have been able to expand not just the number of people we serve, but the array of services that are available to people, and particularly people who are struggling to reconnect with the labor market. So I just wanted to give you some perspective about what that change has meant in our region. So in 2006, programs that we managed served about 6,000 people. Last year, the four quarters ending June 30th of 2014, which is the end of our fiscal year, WorkSource Portland Metro served 101,400 people. 56,488 of them engaged in skill development services. 38,562 of them were placed in jobs at an average wage of $17.04 an hour. And they earned collectively $507,847,000 the first 6 months after exiting the program. So this change has been remarkable. I think the standards that were mentioned by Jim Farr and Lisa earlier are a step forward. They're going to really help us assure a level of consistency across the state. So as Jim mentioned, someone in Southern Oregon can expect the same level of minimum services as someone in the Portland metropolitan area. And it's also going to assure a level of accountability across the board, because the final thing I would say is, because of the depth of this partnership, I think that there is no better system across the state that operates as consistently as WorkSource Oregon. And I will say, it is not perfect. But this is about progress, not perfection. I wouldn't come here and say that my relationship with the Oregon Employment Department is perfect. It's not. It's like a family. We fight, we squabble, we quibble. But at the end of the day, we are all working towards the same end. And that's really what's important. That's about serving Oregonians, both workers, job seekers, and businesses as effectively as possible. So thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGough. And again, as I said, we'll hold questions till we're finished. Mr. Edmund.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomber, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for having me here today. Wanted to give some context to the numbers you've been
and
here.
And I know I just said it, but you have to tell us your name yourself.
Yep. My name's Todd Edmund. I'm the CEO of Lunar Logic. Lunar Logic is a small software firm and digital marketing firm based in Eugene, Oregon. And so we work with WorkSource Lane. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about my experience working with the Employment Department and the WorkSource Department. I started working with them actually through the on-the-job training program, and was in a position at the time where I knew that I was looking at growth in my industry. So while a lot of industries declined over the last few years, you know, mine has grown in computers and related services sectors has grown 14% on an annual basis. So I knew I was in a position where I was potentially going to be looking at growth, and I wanted to be able to hire employees. But recovering from the economic downturn was also difficult for my business. The on-the-job training program allowed me to take some risks and bring some staff members on that I probably would not have done, or I can say absolutely I would not have done, if it weren't for the on-the-job training program. That led me to develop a relationship with the workforce program, which was wonderful, because what ended up happening, because I hired those employees, was a new contract came up shortly thereafter that I'd never been able to service, that I was able to get. And that fundamentally changed my business. I hired employee number, at the time I did the on-the-job training, that was my ninth employee that I hired at the time. Yesterday I hired my 37th employee.
Wow.
My sector, average wage in my sector is about $82,000 a year. There's a lot of growth in that sector, but it was specifically my relationship with the employment department that led me to that on-the-job training program. Additionally, that led to my building a relationship with the WorkSource Center. And they started to know my business and the type of employees I looked for and who I hired. And they started calling me when they had candidates. And I ended up hiring several of those candidates that still work with me today. So I can say it was an immensely effective thing. And at the time, the only services that I used for hiring was basically Craigslist. And this fundamentally changed my understanding of what the WorkSource department could do for me in my business, and it was so energizing that I decided I wanted to participate on the committee and the board, and I believe I was the first person from technology to serve on the board in Lane County. And it continues to be an engaging thing for me. It continues to be a big driver, I believe, for myself. I've been able to introduce a number of other technology firms in Eugene to the different programs that they have, and I know that they're continuing to refer good candidates into that industry. And I've also formed relationships and started to work in the center strategy team specifically targeted at technology in Lane County. So I really see that this kind of client-centric, where it's making the business as the client, has really been wonderful for my business and wonderful for a number of other growing technology businesses in Lane County. Thank you much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Senator Johnson.
A comment and a question. First of all, I can't not welcome a constituent. Oregon Aero is a wonderful company.
Thank you.
I have seen the exchange of emails that have come back and forth between soldiers in the fields of battle in Iraq and Afghanistan who are alive because of the really phenomenal technology employed by this company that is far more than an aviation company. People are alive because of the products that Oregon Aero makes, and it is with great pride that I say you're in my district. My question is really for Mr. McGough. Could you explain the relationship? How are you legally structured? Are you a 501c3? Is this a contract that you have with the agency?
Yeah.
Help me understand the legal construct.
So we're a 501c3 independent organization that's really established through a consortium agreement between the City of Portland, Washington, and Multnomah Counties. So under the Federal Workforce Investment Act, which is the primary federal investment and workforce development programs, the money travels to the state of Oregon, and under the law, it has to be distributed to local areas through workforce investment boards. The governor designates those areas, and then local elected officials form those boards. Well, in Washington and Multnomah counties, and I always include the City of Portland because under the law, any single jurisdiction of 500,000 or more could just take their money on their own and set up their own independent board. But the City of Portland sort of recognized, I think, in a good way, that the economy really functions at a regional level. And so they joined with Multnomah and Washington counties and created this consortium, which evolved into Work Systems, which is the 501c3 that's designated to receive those federal dollars. So in addition to receiving those dollars, our mission is to pursue and invest additional dollars to skill up and improve the quality of the workforce across the region. So those federal dollars constitute about half of our revenue. The others are competitive federal grants, local dollars, and then the role of my staff is, in addition to sort of the money management and contract oversight and the grant It's really to engage industry to understand what are the drivers for various industries in the region, trying to figure out what are smart strategies that work for a variety of different people, that skill up people in ways that directly serve those industries.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Is your relationship with the agency a competitive contract? Is it refreshed periodically?
We don't contract with the agency. We partner with the agency. So we make investments through WorkSource. So, for example, we invested about $20 million last year to skill up regional workers. All of those customers come through the WorkSource system because we are able to then take advantage of all of the services, resources, activity that are available through the Oregon Employment Department. And then we make investments into that system in collaboration with the Oregon Employment Department to basically build a better mousetrap, to make sure that we have a much wider variety of services available to people, so that our focus really is on skill development, on training, investing in training. So if someone comes into a WorkSource office and they need additional skills in order to reconnect with the labor market, we'll invest in skilling that person up. Whereas the employment service will figure out, oh, they need investments to skill themselves up, and then they'll do the placement work on the back end. So we have a much broader set of services available for that individual, and we're all staying in our respective lanes but creating a much better service package.
Follow up again.
Please.
Maybe this is just the end of a long day and I'm particularly dense, but I'm having trouble understanding. You're the actual provider of the services?
No, we contract for organizations to provide those services within WorkSource. So let me give you an example. At the Willow Creek site, which is on a college campus, right. It's on Portland Community College, we fund probably about 7 full-time staff who are college staff. We fund those staff to be co-located in that facility with Oregon Employment Department staff to offer additional services that aren't traditionally offered by the Oregon Employment Department. Those staff also have access to resources. So if someone says, I need to go take a college class in accounting, they have resources to provide to that individual to go get that accounting class and acquire that credential. Then they hand the person off to the employment service people, who then place that person in a job.
Is it a fee-for-service arrangement?
It's free.
Okay. Who does the triage? Let's assume that I show up and I say I'd like to be a veterinarian. Who says at your age this is probably not a clear career path? You got too far to go to get there. Do you do one-on-one counseling, or
yes,
you just walk through the door and anybody gets whatever they want?
No. Our resources are limited, as you've observed, and I think so we target those investments to industries and occupations we know are growing in the regional economy. So unfortunately, if you wanted to pursue veterinary science, we would say, that's great, we can't support you, but here's a FAFSA application and we'll help you complete that if you're really, dead set on doing that. However, if you want to acquire TIG welding skills, we're happy to talk about a co-investment in those skills because we're supportive of manufacturing. And that's done by the people that we resource in those facilities.
One last
that
question.
Counseling.
Sure.
Is there a fiscal threshold? Do people have to meet a certain economic profile to get the free services or the paid-for accounting class at PCC?
Yeah, yes. There's a prioritization for low-income individuals, low-income adults, and then obviously there's a variety of pots of money, which actually adds to the confusion. But yes, there are prioritized resources, and they're primarily targeted towards individuals who need additional assistance in order to pursue training or acquire additional skills.
Thank you.
Thanks for your patience, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Well, I really want to thank all three of you for coming forward and sharing your stories and for the good work that you're doing out there, and really thank appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, Director, we're going to bring you back up, and you can decide who you'd like to bring with you. By my count, I think we have three presentations plus DAS to go, and I'm thinking if we take about 10 minutes or less each, we'll be fine. Otherwise, we'll ask you to come in at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, and Ms. Deister will be here, and we'll ask Rep. Nierman to chair the committee. He'll come in from Polk County and take your testimony first thing Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excuse me.
Co-Chair Gomberg.
Yes, Co-Chair Gomberg. We are changing up the order. Right now, I'll explain why in a minute, but Gary Tyler from the Office of Administrative Hearings is going to go next.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Gary Tyler. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Office of Administrative Hearings was formed back in 2000 by the legislature, and the purpose of that action was to create a more fair and independent hearings process for the citizens of the state of Oregon. We were placed within the Employment Department at that time. The Chief Administrative Law Judge, my position, manages the Office of Administrative Hearings. Since that formation, that the appointment of that position has shifted from the Director of the Employment Department to the Governor, appointing my position. Administrative support for the Office of Administrative Hearings comes from the Employment Department, and we reimburse the Employment Department for the cost of those services under the statute. We are overseen by a nine-member oversight committee made up of representatives from the House, from the Senate, from the Governor's Office, and from the Department of Justice. And that committee meets each year, usually. And they're charged with overseeing the operations of the Office of Administrative Hearings and making recommendations to the legislature and to the governor on matters pertaining to our functioning. So the slide here that I have is for the purpose of just showing you the internal organization of the Office of Administrative Hearings. We're organized into five different program areas centered around the major types of hearings that we do. So we have the Employment Department, and under that you see some of the types of hearings that we perform, that we conduct for the Employment Department. The Department of Transportation, primarily implied consent, is the big area of hearings that we do for that agency. The Department of Justice, Division of Child Support, then the Department of Human Services, including Oregon Health Authority, and then the rest of the group of agencies, boards, and commissions. We actually hold hearings for about 60 different agencies, boards, and commissions each year, and the agencies are required to use the Office of Administrative Hearings to conduct hearings unless they're exempted specifically by statute. I would say about a third of our time is spent doing unemployment hearings, and then about 25% of our time spent doing implied consent hearings, and the rest of our time is spread out over the remaining program areas that we have. We do conduct hearings in person. We travel throughout the state. We go down, we go to Klamath Falls, we go east to Enterprise, LeGrand, and Pendleton. We hit the coast at Astoria and Seaside, Lincoln City, Newport. So we cover a large area. We have offices, major offices, in Salem, Tualatin, Eugene, Bend, and Medford, Oregon. Probably our major accomplishment recently has been to develop and close out phase one of our case management system. When the Office of Administrative Hearings was formed, we inherited case management systems from nine different agencies. And since that time, we've been trying to consolidate. And so the case management project developed as a way to consolidate all of those case management systems into one centralized system, and we've been successful in phase one, and so we're now operational for about 75% of our work. That allows for, it's very, if you're familiar with the circuit court system and, that they're using now with eCourt, it's very similar to that. So we're moving to electronic filings and real-time capabilities for the agencies to come into the system through their own portal and pull documents and see what the status of the case is, and even get digital recordings within hours of when the hearing was held if they choose to do so. Some of the challenges that we're facing, we have policy option 139, which is to continue phase two of the case management system, so we can expand that to the remaining agencies that we haven't developed that for yet. As I said, we have about 20, we covered about 75% of our work, but we have another 25% to go, and we'd like to complete that so that we have one consolidated case management system. We're facing some reductions in the number of hearing referrals, primarily with the end of the recession. Some of the UI hearings have reduced, but we're also seeing an increase in some of the more complex hearings that take a little longer and cost a little more. So that's going to probably drive up our cost per disposition over this next biennium. And then finally, we have a policy option package for the transition of the OAH, the Office of Administrative Hearings, from the Employment Department to DAS for administration of our entity.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Before you leave that, well, you're going to talk about it now, so why don't I wait until after you're done with your presentation to pose my question.
Okay. Well, let me say a little bit more. So proposed legislation, we have House Bill 2438, which transfers administration of the Office of Administration from the Employment Department, where we were originally embedded, over to DAS. This is designed to improve the perception of fairness. We conduct approximately 20,000 hearings a year for the Employment Department, and the people that come to those hearings are often confused about how we can perform those hearings when we actually work for the Employment Department. And we're confronted with that probably in each hearing that the administrative law judge conducts. They have to take time to explain that while they're part of the Employment Department, they really are going to be independent in that hearing process. So when you do that 20,000 times a year, it takes a lot of time, and not everybody buys that explanation. So we began looking for a different alternative way to be supported. We looked at some of the other agencies that were possibilities. When we came to DAS, we conducted last year 9 hearings for DAS. And we were looking, in addition to low hearing counts, so to eliminate that confusion, we were looking for an agency that could provide the administrative support that we need. DAS was set up to do that, so we've been working with DAS for some time now to take a look at that and explore the feasibility of that transfer of administrative support from the Employment Department to DAS. This would not involve a physical move of the OAH. It would just be a shift in who supports us. So we have package 112, which transfers the proposed budget for the OAH from the Employment Department over to DAS, along with the positions associated with that. That's what that package is about. There is language that supports the House Bill 2438 language. We have policy option package 139, which is...
Now may I renew my question. Have you priced this move?
We have taken a look at it. We've talked to DAS about it. And in our conversations with DAS, the concept was to replace what is provided by the Employment Department, by DAS. So as far as the Office of Administrative Hearings is concerned, we did not see an impact in that move. We have three FTE that work in the Employment Department, but their position, they're in our budget, that have been providing the administrative support through the Employment Department in the areas of human resources, technology, and budgeting. Those positions would be transferred over to DAS as well. We see it as a lift and drop ourselves.
I'm going to pose a question to the professional staff. If I looked at DAS's budget right now, would it reflect just the three?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is a fiscal impact statement that has been issued on the bill. And I believe DAS's portion talks about potential for seven positions associated with that to receive them over on their end.
Co-Chair Gomberg and Senator Johnson, I'm aware of that they have done that, that DAS has done that. I've not been have not had a conversation with them as to why they feel that is necessary.
Just Senator, to be clear, until that's reconciled, I'm going to have a lot of trouble with that policy option package. I just want to tell you, I am asking the professional staff to flag that. I need to know why. Because if we're just trying to eliminate the optics of where these people sit, I'd like to know at what cost. And if it's the delta between three people and seven people, that's a considerable amount of money.
That's a fair question, Senator Johnson.
Senator Hansel.
Not knowing the setup and where you're currently located, will you actually have a physical move as well from where you are now for your...
Co-Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, no, we would not. We would stay at our current physical location. We would keep our printers and our vehicles. Our contracts would just transfer over the leases that we have. Would be assumed by DAS, so there would be no physical move of the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Please.
I would concur with Senator Johnson then, because if you're not moving physically, and why where you are now requires three, and if you change department heads, it moves to seven, I would need an explanation as well.
Thank you.
Ms. Dyster, did you have some observation?
I would just note that the seven people are on DAS's end. They wouldn't be necessarily for the Office of Administrative Hearings per se. So that is something that I believe the General Government Subcommittee is going to be looking at in terms of DAS as the receiving agency. And it'll be our responsibility in LFO to help reconcile those two things so that the two subcommittees know, you know, what the right hand knows what the left is doing. So we'll try to keep on top of that for you.
Please.
That completes my presentation.
All right. I had one quick question for you. You indicated that, are most of your employment hearings conducted by telephone?
Yes, they are.
Most or all? Or?
Well, two-thirds at least, because the only hearings that are conducted routinely by in person are implied consent hearings. So those have to be conducted in person unless the... Well, the parties can opt for telephone hearings. They can opt out of that process, but most of them end up being conducted by telephone. I mean, excuse me, in person.
All right, so most of our employment hearings are conducted by telephone, or the great majority of them.
Yes.
Reconcile that with the fact that you have your satellite offices spread around rather than focusing all of that work in one place.
Well, we have the satellite offices primarily for the implied consent hearings process. So we have a presence there of administrative law judges that can do those implied consent hearings.
Okay.
So that is why we have the satellite offices.
Right. Understood. Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Tyler.
Thank you.
Director?
I'm going to have to rely on Larry to help me here. So, Co-Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, Gerald Fahrenkopf, was our CIO, was going to be here today to talk about our IT program. However, they carted him off to the hospital earlier today. I was assured it wasn't to do with this hearing. So we have asked Salvador Jarenas, our deputy director, to step in. The IT program reports to Salvador, and so he has agreed to step in and help us on this area.
I have a meeting with the governor's staff on education funding.
I'll do
it.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Nernes, I'm sorry?
Jarenas.
Jarenas, excuse me. Please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomber, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Salvador Jarenas. I'm the deputy director of the agency. As Lisa indicated, Gerald was taken to the hospital this morning. We understand he's okay.
Okay.
We wish him a speedy recovery. Puts me in a position to be the designated batter. So I may have to defer some of the questions for later. As you may be aware, the OED IT department had a reputation of dysfunction and a history of failed projects. Over the last year and a half, we've been working in restructuring our department and in a functional area, then we'll meet our agency needs, our partners' needs, and the Oregonians that we serve. We have hired managers for each one of our functional areas. We have surveyed our IT staff to better understand their skills and their interests, and we are looking to bring training to meet our gaps. As we are transforming our IT department, we need to keep the lights on. So this has been a great challenge for us, and we are very proud of our IT shop today. As part of the reorganization that we are then going through in our IT department, we have created our strategic plan that will meet the needs and support the agency strategic plan and vision. Our four overarching principles for our IT shop strategic plan is keeping the lights on, striving towards providing modern services, investing in modern technologies, and process improvement. We had a history of building our system from within. We are walking away from that concept, and we are embracing the buy versus build model. Our new IT team is embracing the cultural shift of customer service first mentality versus dictating the technology that will be used in our agency. So we foresee then our great strives are happening in our department and our IT department. We have two major accomplishments this year. One is the rebuild of our project management office for IT. We have a standardized templates and the requirements of all IT projects, and we'll continue to will utilize our state CIO stage gate methodology. One of our second accomplishments is the formation of our agency governance committee, which would allow the agency to prioritize projects within the limited time and resources of our available IT shop. So why are we doing this? Because we want to modernize our infrastructure and our business and IT infrastructure. So we see that this is our necessary steps to come to you to have a major ask. As I said, modernizing our systems yesterday, Director Eisenfeld and our Assistant Director for UI Division spoke about COBOL, antiquated legacy systems that we have. We believe then we need to bring this new technology to our agency. We understand we have to go through the stage gate in coordination with the state CIO's office. And then we will require
to bring outside help for feasibility study, project management, technical architecture, assistance, and quality assurance. We, part of this high-level plan then we want to embark on, it will require assess the market for available solutions, identify future needs and possible solutions, continue to follow our buy versus build strategy, looking for products that have been successfully implemented in other states, work well, and have secure requirements that meet our environment. We also need to ensure that our solutions are scalable, reliable, and easy to maintain and support. As you may have read on the newspaper, last fall we were hacked. Our WorkSource Oregon Management Information System was subject to a security breach. This system allows our customers to register for job search assistance and other services. Once we identified the breach, we worked with the State Enterprise Security Office, our state CIO, and other agency technical teams to fix the gap and identify the customers that may have been impacted by this breach. We have learned many things. We understand that we need to do a better job to monitor records retention schedule for software applications. Then we need to keep our systems up to date. We need to formally document our project and applications. We need to strengthen our offboarding procedures and routinely apply security best practices. We are extremely grateful to the state CIO, the Enterprise Security Office, and the many other agencies that assist us throughout this unfortunate circumstance. We also learn many lessons from the Secretary of State as they share what they have learned. A second ask then we'll have on the IT ROM will be our policy option package 104. When we drafted this policy option package, we said there have been no breaches. Things changed, unfortunately. And part of this request on package 104 is our security update software necessary to bring some of our systems up to date. We understand that many major breaches have occurred across industries, and then we need to be more diligent when it comes to our customer information and security. We also understand that we need to address what we know today and be ready for what may come tomorrow. We are committed to continue assessing our security needs for better monitoring, detection, and prevention. We have already begun the update of our security processes and procedures while making sure that we're meeting state and federal security requirements. That's the end of my presentation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Senator.
Very good job. Thank you.
Chair.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much for being with us. Please extend our best wishes to Mr. Fahrenkopf and tell him that we'd much rather he had been here with us.
So do I. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much. Director?
Yes. Our Chief Financial Officer, Larry Nieswander, is going to go over the POPs.
Great. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Gomberg and Senator Johnson. For the record, I'm the Interim Chief Financial Officer. My name is Larry Nieswander. As the director indicated, we're at the portion of our presentation where we want to talk briefly about the policy option packages that this agency is bringing forward. In the way of a financial reminder, as the director said, we have been right-sizing the agency. We have been relying on less federal resources, and so you see our budget has been reduced significantly from the legislatively approved budget that was before you. And in fact, it's almost $300 million less, and it's about 164 FTE less than last biennium. So the agency has been right-sizing, and when you see us ask for positions or limited duration positions or permanent positions, it is to continue some of the work that we are already doing, because limited duration positions have to be reauthorized every biennium. We have a total of 14 policy packages. That may sound like a lot on its face. Five of those are here because they are policy legislation that is working its way through the process. Two of those bills are already referred to Ways and Means, and I'll talk about those briefly. One will be there soon. Nonetheless, those will live and die based on the other legislative process they're going through right now. The other nine policy packages, and I'll touch on them at a high level, some of them are self-funded. Some of them are funded by outside sources. Some of them are necessary for federal conformity with law, or we risk the loss of revenue from not complying with federal law. And some of them are to do what you've heard the speakers before me talk about, enhancing facilities so that we increase customer service, providing a more secure environment for the information that we provide, and increasing access to important systems for employers that report their employment taxes to us. So with that, this slide is just to show you, the first one is just to show you all those packages. The ones that are at the bar at the top and the bottom show that they cross program area lines, so they are serving broadly across the agency. The next slide, I'll dive into these and touch them at a high level. Know that behind the scenes, this agency has been working with both the Chief Financial Office and the Legislative Fiscal Office to do detailed analysis of these packages, and we will continue to do that prior to the work session. So a lot of the questions are being asked and being answered because of the staff's due diligence on these. So we want to still touch them at a high level for you today, though. As Salvador spoke a few minutes ago about a technology enhancement package to modernize, Package 101 is to do that. It is $1.9 million. It is from funds that we have received for modernization. As you recall, the director spoke about that. We received approximately $85 million. This spends $1.9 million of those modernization funds to get to the first stage gate in a process which would allow us, once approved, to start a multi-biennial technology improvement project and business improvement project at the employment department. This first package is a slice of that to get us through a feasibility study to further inform business requirements and next steps. So there are staff that are asked for in this one because it is staff intensive, and the staff that we do have are fully committed to existing work. So the FTE is limited because we want to get to the first stage gate, get approval, and then we would ask for additional authority to continue those staff once we had both the approval of the Chief CIO's office and the legislative body.
Senator Johnson.
Are you finding that you're getting the proper information and coordination at all levels that you need to begin to think about a big IT project? Are you communicating well with the Chief Information Officer? Are the Executive Branch and the Legislative Fiscal Office giving you adequate guidance? Are you finding a clear path of instruction to begin thinking about a large biennial modernization package?
Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson and committee members, I'll be speaking on behalf of Gerald, the CIO, who I've worked alongside for the last 8 months, and I will, from my direct observations, the answer to your question is yes. There are regular meetings with the CIO's office, there are regular meetings with the LFO office, and there is ongoing communication. And so we are starting to really build those relationships and that certainty, and then take these projects in small, doable steps and get agreement and concurrence and comfort in small, doable steps to set us on a successful path.
Follow?
Please.
And everybody has a copy of the autopsy of Cover Oregon and Scenic next to their bedside reading table?
Is there one?
I, all joking aside, I think that there have been postmortems of our less successful projects going all the way back to a failed DMV project where we squandered $100 million. Yeah. And I think that lessons learned from those are going to be terribly important.
Yes, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the committee, we are also looking very closely at where other states have failed in this same business, in the unemployment insurance and job placement business. And where they have succeeded. And our commitment, again, is to only purchase tried and true tools that have been demonstrated to work in other states that we can then bring to Oregon. And I think that was one of the signal failures of prior projects. State of California squandered millions of dollars. The number I've heard, I've never verified it, is $100 million on a UI modernization project that didn't work. Now, whether they've been able to rescue it or not, I don't know. But Florida, Massachusetts, many states have had these issues. So we're paying very close attention to those and learning their lessons. And we've been holding back, waiting to see what works.
Thank you. That's very comforting.
So the next slide is to just speak a little bit higher level about Package 104. This is a package that Salvador just spoke to briefly, too. This is a security and compliance package, which is a funding authority of slightly less than $1 million. There is no staff associated with this. This is to do what Salvador briefly referenced, to take and implement 8 different initiatives to reduce the risks of security breaches, data theft, and compromises to data systems. So we have had this in preparation, and we hope that this will be a very well-accepted opportunity to protect the information that we're required to under the federal requirements, as well as what our employers that report to us expect. The next slide, Package 102. So benefit payment control staffing. So David Gerstenfeld spoke to this package briefly. It is an opportunity for us to continue to staff the and enhance our ability to prevent overpayments, detect them, and increase our recovery efforts. So in the past 2 biennia, we have done this with limited duration staff, 12 to be exact. This, because of the ongoing nature of this work, because of the ongoing challenge that it represents, we are asking in this package for 9 permanent staff, because it's not a temporary job, and to get permanent staff, you might get a higher quality staff. You also get the skills and ability that we need to do enhanced levels of recovery efforts. And when you read the detail of this package, you'll see that there's an investment of approximately $1.4 million in other funds and federal funds for this. But also in that package, you'll see there's over $11 million in expected revenue to return to the state as a result of the recovery efforts. So we hope for the committee's support for that package as well. In the interest of time, I will move on to the next package, Package 106. So Oregon's payroll and reporting system. This is a package for $1.6 million, no staff involved again. Right now, we do not have a front-end security system that works for the public. And we've had a failed attempt to develop a front-end system in the past, and we want authority to implement a new system. We want for a competitive solicitation and implement one as well. That will work. Right now, the system we have is very costly to develop. It's outdated and cumbersome, and it's time-consuming and expensive to operate. So we know that it's difficult also for others to use. So we want to upgrade that system and make it more efficient, more effective, and also accessible to the public, and it will enhance the level of employers to have access and efficiency for them as well. The system is at risk. If it failed, we would be left with nothing other than a paper process to accept this information. The next package is Package 111. So I mentioned we have some requirements for federal conformity. This is a package that is here because of Senate Bill 242, which is in Ways and Means. It is, as David Gerstenfeld testified, a bill that would increase our ability to collect overpayments and tax debts and increase the participation in a work share program. As a result of that, there's some increased workload. And so you see four positions, 2.5 FTE, in this package as well. In the narrative for this, you will also see that we expect to recover nearly $500,000 recoveries that we will see in the TOP program as a result of this. And again, without federal conformity, we are at risk of losing some federal funds. So we are moving that forward, and the bills have been well received and are in Ways and Means at this time. Package 113, David Gerstenfeld from the UI department also spoke to this bill. This is House Bill 2439. So we are no staffing impact, no spending impact policy bill, but it is to allow us to receipt, track, and review hearing requests and then dismiss them within the agency when, in fact, they are ready for dismissal. It streamlines the process for them. We can do it with existing staff, and it is a flexibility that other agencies have as well. So we have are recommending approval of that policy bill as well. Again, it may not find its way to Ways and Means because it has no staff or budget impact. Package 114, recovery of overpayments, Senate Bill 243. So David Gerstenfeld again spoke to this briefly yesterday. It authorizes Oregon to use this interstate reciprocal overpayment recovery arrangement. So no staff or dollars are involved in this one either, but it does help us with, brings us into compliance with federal law. And if it's not approved, we have some risks of loss of some funds for lack of conformity. So as he mentioned, major benefits to this is it allows us to additional circumstances under which we can recover an overpayment and increases the length of time that a recovery can be made from 3 to 5 years. Package 115, benefit eligibility package. So this is a package that that really gives a slight increase in benefit, $129,000 over a biennium, to allow the state agency to allow people who need to leave the area to seek employment. So if under the current law, if a person leaves the area for a majority of a week to seek employment, say in California, they are ineligible for unemployment. It's a disincentive for them to go and find work. So this bill will address that issue and will have much greater benefits than we currently have the ability to provide. Package 103. So Jim spoke briefly to the business and employment services that they provide. This is a package that where we provide direct service primarily to the Department of Human Services. So this is a package that we have asked for over six biennia, and each biennia that has been staffed with limited duration positions. So currently we have workload that justifies 26 FTE. In looking at this, we've seen a baseline over the last five or six biennia of no less than 18 full-time FTE being engaged and involved in this process. So it is contingent on DHS's continued funding. They have supported this package to this point, and it has 18 permanent and 10 limited duration to allow us to flex and fill when workload justifies the need for that. It allows them to have specialized services to help with their job opportunity skills, temporary assistance need families, the food stamp program, and vocational rehabilitation services. So again, it's externally driven. They're asking for our services to continue, and if this package weren't approved, their service levels would significantly reduce.
Excuse me. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. You seemed a little tentative about whether or not DHS was going to continue this. Tell me about the back-channel communications that would suggest they are.
Co-Chair Gomberg and Senator Johnson, committee members, it just is contingent on the funding of in their budget, and so whenever it's interdependency, it depends on the outcome of that. I don't have any reason to believe there isn't going to be support for that package within DHS. It's just it's a possibility that it might. We would have to want to flex this at work session if in fact the funding for this has changed.
Follow, please, Mr. Chair. So is it safe to say that if the DHS budget does not contain a reciprocal provision for this, you would abandon POP 103?
Coach Gomberg and Senator Johnson, this package relies on their revenue to be transferred to us to support these. It's a contracted service, so they are paying for it. So if they didn't have the funds to do it, our ability to provide those services would go away with that.
Thank you.
Next package is package 107. So trade assistance package 107. This is to address workload. So over multiple biennia now, the department has used limited duration staff. You see 19 limited duration staff in this package as well. We're continuing with those staff. It depends on workload. This is the same number of FTE we are currently using to support this program, in addition to 12 FTE that are permanent. So this is to continue and maintain our effort to support the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. It's established under the Federal Trade Act, and it does, as a way of a reminder, it provides a variety of services and benefits to assisted workers who've lost their jobs due to foreign competition.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
I don't know all the rules of this. I know that it's been helpful in my personal experience in dealing with some constituents. Is it too far a stretch to see whether or not the 650 jobs that will be affected by the withdrawal of Hanjin from Terminal 6, would they fit in here? It is trade-related, but I just don't know whether the rules are sufficiently elastic to allow those displaced workers to qualify.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the committee, that is determined by the U.S. Department of Labor, and it has been a somewhat flexible definition over the last several years. But each, as an employer, withdraws jobs, those employees with us petition the U.S. Department of Labor to be certified under the Trade Act. And therefore eligible for these services. And so we would be checking with them to see if this counts. The original definition was that it was jobs that were lost due to foreign trade shifts. Whether the transportation would count there is kind of a gray area. So we would rely on the Department of Labor to help us there. But we would certainly lobby for that.
Mr. Chair. I would respectfully ask that your staff do a little preliminary inquiry, because several of us had a briefing this morning from Bill Wyatt, the executive director of the Port of Portland, and he was talking about the sweeping ramifications, our products becoming non-competitive in Asian markets because of the additional $1,200 cost to truck or rail them to Seattle or Tacoma. If product does not leave Oregon, these are low value, high volume, like hay and other commodities of that ilk, that then those could be dumped into the Oregon market and driving prices down. The picture that he painted of the fiscal ramifications of Hanjin's decision to leave the Port of Portland were dire. And I would just respectfully ask that maybe you do some preliminary inquiry to see what, if anything, your agency, what role, if any, your agency yes. might have in buffering those job losses.
And Co-Chair Johnson, in addition to Trade Act resources to assist those employees, we have dislocated worker resources with our colleagues from the workforce boards, and can also petition for there's a Federal Reserve of those funds for these really cataclysmic economic developments. So we would also look into those as well.
Thank you, because cataclysmic is exactly how I describe this.
Indeed. Two more packages, and then I'm done. We'll go to the CFO presentation. Package 109. So Jim talked about this a little bit. This is a package that asks for authority to spend $5.6 million in other funds to enhance the customer flow and integration of services at various WorkSource centers around the state. We estimate that we could potentially modify between 20 to 25 facilities with this amount of money over the course of the biennium to provide customer service and coordinated service delivery. This is something that right now the physical design of these facilities is in the way of that. And We need an environment that encourages continuous and meaningful engagement, and this will allow us to make some modifications at facilities. Some are owned by the Employment Department. Some are in long-term leases. And last package, package 116. So you see numbers in red on this one, and that's because this is a self-funded package. This is a package that the agency basically identified 20 positions that were non-critical, not filled, and put together a package that would abolish those 20 positions, create 12 positions we consider critical to the ability of the agency to meet the technology improvement needs, meet the operational needs, for a net reduction of 8 positions and a net reduction of expenditure authority as well. So it was a little late in the biennium for us to do it as a permanent finance package, something that agencies can do in the interim, but at the time it was so close to the governor's budget development that we put it in a policy package to bring it before you for your review. With that, that's the last package I wanted to talk about. In closing, I would just say we have some technical adjustments that we will be working with LFO staff on prior to the work session that we hope to get your support for as well.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Director, anything do you have for us in closing?
No. As we get further information, we will get back to each of you. We'll be happy also to provide any of you with further information on our technology issues or any other part of the budget. So please do not hesitate to call. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, indeed. Now, thank you to you and your team for moving things along so efficiently. I apologize if anybody felt they were rushed a little bit, but we will not be needing you on Saturday morning. I'll go ahead and let you go. Ms. Lisper, I can't imagine what's been going through your mind for the last 2 days while you've been sitting quietly on the edge of the table waiting your turn.
Not too much. Sorry.
But let me interrupt for just a moment. Colleagues, I know some of you may have commitments. We're officially supposed to conclude at 4:30. If you need to leave, please go ahead and you'll be listed as excused. And I'm just going to go ahead and allow DAS to wrap things up so we can finish this agenda item today.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Gomberg and Johnson and committee members. I'm Michelle Lisper with the Chief Financial Office. Much of what I would have in my presentation was well covered by the Department of Employment. Some key areas and I will make it brief and bring up some key points. They talked about some of their emerging issues. I do want to reiterate that one of the emerging issues is the one-time or proposed one-time transfer of $37.9 million of CDAP to the general fund that the agency is doing related to programs in education and the coordinating commissions. That transfer and the support by the governor's budget was designed specifically for youth employment, incumbent workers, training restructuring, and ongoing workforce programs, as well as portions for community leverage fund. Sorry, I've got to read from my notes. The economy improves, as they've talked about, there are federal government fundings that have been in programs that have been discontinued, much of it because of the non-need for the emergency unemployment compensation as we move upwards from the recession. Some of the other areas in the 10-year plan for Oregon, the Department of Employment has made streamlining efforts in guiding for the 10-year principle of the plan. They have worked with local governments, the workforce investment boards. They have been working towards streamlining for job seekers and employers. And I know I'm cutting this. Whoops. I'm not going to go too much into the expenditure history, but it does show the drop in FTE, that they have been downsizing and right-sizing their needs for their programs as they go forward in effort. And I did want to indicate that the big drop in the federal is a lot to do with Children's Services moving to early learning. So that's a big drop from actuals to 15-17 over that time. The other point I'd like to make is that, you know, when we look at operational costs for the agency, 86% does go out in special payments for unemployment insurance, community college, workforce department, and displaced job seekers, which is a big impact on how they deal with their budgets. And only 14% is for operational needs. They've covered a lot in their revenue history. I'm going to pass that slide. They did go over most of their investments through their policy option packages. I will mention that the policy option package 139, where they talk about dealing with phase two for OAH, is in DAS's, as a technical adjustment in DAS's budget for that case management system, and why it's not in the governor's budget because of the support and transfer from OAH to DAS. So you won't see it in our piece of it. Most of it, for sparing of time, has already been covered by them and our support in the rest of their policy packages. And I'm open to questions if you've got any.
Any questions?
That I can possibly answer.
All right, I think we're good, Ms. Lisper, and I thank you for your patience. I'm going to go ahead. I should ask, is there anybody that came to testify that didn't get signed up? I didn't think so. I'm going to go ahead and conclude the hearing on 5508. Colleagues, anything else we need to cover today? Then we will reconvene on
Mr. Chair,
Monday.
I want to thank you for giving me my Saturday back.
But
I want to thank you for giving me my Saturday.